This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. A number of public opinion polls have shown that a majority of Americans are concerned about the cost of energy, the future of fossil fuels, and global warming. So on the program today, we're going to get some ideas for going green at home. Our guest is the president of Building Green Incorporated, Alex Wilson, the editor of Environmental Building News. Alex Wilson is the author of several books, including Your Green Home, a guide to planning a healthy, environmentally friendly new home. It would be useful if you're planning on building a home or are planning to renovate an existing home. The book provides guidance on a number of topics, including whether to build or renovate, where to build, design priorities, energy design strategies, selecting building materials, indoor air quality, and landscaping. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Alex Wilson. Maybe you have an experience involving making a green home. We'd love to hear from you. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Your Green Home is published by New Society Publishers. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Alex Wilson, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's great to be here, Celeste.
One of the things you say early in the book is that green building is not only about a particular building, it's also about the relationship between that building and the larger community. Would you, here at the outset, talk with us about the connections between green building and community?
Sure. A lot of people, when they hear the term green building or building a green home, think about just the house itself. But when we really look at the overall impact, the environmental impacts of homes, we see that a significant percentage of the impact has to do with getting to and from our homes, driving there in our automobiles. So one strategy for greening our homes is to really look at where we're building. This is if you're building a new home, where we build and what the opportunities are for use of public transit, for walking to nearby services, for bicycling, and so forth.
Yeah. Also, neighborhood is important, at least to me. Having a strong connection with neighbors, and that might involve a nearby park, a nearby library, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And some of the development patterns that I find most exciting today are situations where people live together more on a more involved basis than we're used to. For example, something called co-housing. This is a development pattern that came here from Europe in the last 15 years or so. And it's where people own their own homes, but they cluster them in a small community and share some uses. For example, there might be a common house. They might share some vehicles, lawnmowers, storage space, and so forth.
Gardening also, I suppose, would be a
possibility. Very often, yes.
Yeah. Well, there are so many things that go into making a home a green home. Maybe you could give us an overview of what makes a home green.
Sure. It's the green building movement, as I see it, kind of evolved out of a number of different movements. One was the solar energy movement in the 70s and 80s. Another has been the natural building movement, the healthy building network, healthy building movement. And really, green building is a way to synthesize these all together, to look at not just energy, not just water, not just health, but to address all of these issues at the same time. So creating a green home is really an integrated approach that involves designing and building that addresses where you build, how you orient and configure the house, energy conservation features, including use of renewable energy sources, material choices, and indoor air quality.
It's very interesting. There was an article in the New York Times last month in December of 2006 about Boston changing its building code, going green on large building projects, large private building projects, and the commitment on the part of the city is because the city apparently sees this as, one, fiscally responsible, and two, I don't know necessarily in this order, but a matter of public health, and I suppose public health also involves fiscal responsibility.
Yes, there have been a lot of cities around the country that are now requiring green building practices for their own buildings, for city-owned buildings, and a number of states do this for state-owned buildings, and some federal agencies do as well. But what's much less common is what Boston has done, where they're requiring it for privately owned buildings as well. Now, these are larger buildings. I forget the threshold. I think it's 50,000 square feet. But, it's potentially going to have far greater reach because it deals not just with city buildings, but every building.
Yeah. Well, what's the response been in Boston on the part of people who are involved in development, in real estate, in building?
Well, there's always going to be some resistance when you try to do new things and try to tell builders and developers what they need to do. But I think in general there's been a fairly positive reaction in Boston where, you know, more and more people are recognizing that we really need to do something about global climate change, about air quality, about water consumption, and about health, health of people in buildings. So I think the move has, for the most part, been welcomed by people in Boston. You know, I think it remains to be seen what the reaction is going to be when people, developers, actually try to implement these this program. But I think for the time being, the reaction I'm hearing is fairly good.
Yeah. Now, one of the concerns is that up front the costs are greater, but in the long haul, over the long haul, this is where the fiscal responsibility comes in, that it's really, in the long run, it's sound policy. Maybe you would talk with us about these issues of cost, affordability, and sustainability in the near and long term.
Sure. You know, a lot of people assume that green building costs more than regular building, and indeed it often does cost more. There are plenty of examples out there of high-profile green homes that cost a lot more than conventional homes. But there are lots of ways to build green with little or no added cost. For example, and actually some measures can actually reduce cost. For example, building a smaller house can, you know, reduce the construction cost fairly significantly. If a homeowner thought he or she needed a 3,000-square-foot house, convincing that person to go to a 2,500-square-foot house or a 2,000-square-foot house can allow higher quality construction, better materials, higher levels of energy efficiency, and still save money in the first cost. Now, there are other strategies, designing a house to standard dimensions. In other words, building with 8-foot ceilings instead of 11-foot ceilings so that standard dimension materials can be used. That reduces cutoff waste, which, you know, not only saves money in purchasing the building materials, but also reduces cost in disposal, which has become more expensive in recent years. So anyway, there are some ways to reduce cost or at least contain costs to make them no more than with conventional building. But for the most part, it will cost a little bit more to build green. And the benefit is realized in the long-term operation of that building. It's going to cost less to heat and cool, less to power it with electricity and so forth.
Yeah, I suppose the answer to this next question that I'm going to ask you is it all depends, but is there a point generally where you begin to, where you hit that break-even point where things begin to pay back?
Well, it all depends. the payback on products and systems that are put into a home vary dramatically depending on what the system is. With some products or improvements to a home, for example, replacing an old shower head, and this could be with a new house or an older house, replacing a high-flow shower head with a new high-performance low-flow shower head can pay the cost back in a matter of months by saving in part water, but more significantly the energy needed to heat water for hot water. So some paybacks are very rapid, some take a lot longer, but are still very real and can save huge amounts of money over expected life of a building or expected tenure in which a family is going to be in a particular home.
Mm. You mentioned the shower head. What kind of progress have we seen in products like that in terms of, something that will save you money, but also will perform well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and with some products, for example, shower heads and toilets, some of the early efforts to reduce water consumption dramatically worsened performance.
Mm-hmm.
And, many of us have had, horror stories with toilets that didn't flush properly, or, you try to take a shower in a cheap motel somewhere where they put in these aerators or flow restrictors that kind of give you a hard mist but make it almost impossible to rinse your hair.
Mm-hmm.
Those have done, more damage than good, because they've given a bad name to water conservation. But, we've seen in recent years the newer products coming out are really engineered from the ground up to perform very well with less water. There's a new shower head just introduced last year that we wrote up in our newsletter made by Delta Faucet Company using a technology they call H2O Kinetic technology, where they really redesigned how a shower head works and the types of droplets it forms. And they engineered a shower that delivers fairly large droplets that retain heat very well, so that if you're standing a couple of feet from the spray, the water isn't going to be cold by the time it gets there, as it will when you atomize that water into very tiny droplets. And it delivers a very satisfactory performance using 1.6 gallons per minute. Now, this is something like 35% less water than the national standard of 2.5 gallons per minute. So, we've retained very good performance, yet dramatically reducing the water and energy consumption. And the same thing's happened with toilets, which are even a bigger issue. The early toilets introduced when the Energy Policy Act of 1992 took effect in early 94, very often manufacturers simply took their existing toilet that had been designed to flush with maybe 3 or 3.5 gallons of water and re-engineered the flush valve a little bit so that just less water would go down in flushing it and it would meet the 1.6 gallon per flush federal standard. But they did that without redesigning the bowl and the waste way, the trap at the bottom. So the performance was very poor. The toilets today, even many inexpensive ones, are designed from the ground up to use 1.6 gallons, and they work very satisfactorily with that.
Mm. What's the latest on the front in terms of lighting?
Well, the news with lighting is, pretty much what it's been for the last 10 years or so, where it makes a great deal of sense to replace incandescent light bulbs with fluorescent lighting. And in most applications in homes, this will be compact fluorescent lighting, which are lamps that are about the same size as incandescent light bulbs, with the fluorescent tube either folded or in a spiral so that the light is concentrated. And, replacing standard incandescent light bulbs. Linear fluorescent lamps also can be used, but usually in a recessed application, a cove lighting around a room, for example, that shines up toward the ceiling. But the news with fluorescent lighting is that the light quality has improved. Almost all fluorescent lighting now is using electronic ballasts, so you don't get an annoying flicker or hum when that light is operating. And the size of the compact fluorescents has continued to shrink, making them more suitable for straight replacement of incandescent light bulbs.
And again, here, this is about the quality of the light. I remember years ago being in that motel room with the horrible shower, and they had replaced light bulbs with compact fluorescent lighting, but everything looked kind of green.
Yeah, that has to do with what's referred to as the color temperature of the light source. And, you know, we're used to incandescent light, which has a somewhat yellowish cast, often a color temperature of 3,000 Kelvin. Many of the early fluorescent lighting, and, you know, particularly linear fluorescent in, you know, if you picture a department store you might have gone into in the 70s, you know, that would have been a cool white fluorescent, maybe a color temperature of 5,000 Kelvin. And everything under it looked really bluish, and it made people look sickly, and it was, very unpleasant to be in those spaces. And, you know, the other characteristic besides color temperature is the color rendering index, or CRI. And the better the color rendering index, the more realistic objects look under that light. And quality fluorescent lights today have CRIs of 85 or higher, you know, over 90 in some cases, and that approaches 100 with incandescent light bulbs.
So if
they're getting much better.
Yeah, so if you're in the market for that kind of product, look for that CRI of 85 or above?
Correct.
Okay, very good.
And the other development with lighting that we're beginning to see in homes, but that I think has a great deal of promise over the coming 5 or 10 years, is LED lighting, or light-emitting diode lighting. And, you know, most of us have seen LEDs. The little red indicator lights in stereo equipment are LEDs. In traffic lights, if you look closely at a traffic light, and instead of a big green disc that's uniform, it's made up of little dots, those are LEDs. And the potential savings is fairly significant. You know, today's LEDs are not as efficient, actually, as fluorescent, but there have been dramatic advances in recent years, and the promise is very significant for, you know, greater energy efficiency. And another advantage of the LEDs is that they don't contain mercury. Fluorescent lights contain a little bit of mercury that creates a mercury vapor that allows the light to occur.
Alex Wilson is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's president of Building Green Incorporated, and he is the author of Your Green Home, a guide to planning a healthy, environmentally friendly new home. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us in Urbana on line one. You're on the air with Alex Wilson.
Hi. I've noticed that Philips now makes LED Christmas lights, and the wattage on those for a 60-light strand is something like under 4 watts. And we hadn't bothered doing Christmas lighting in part because of the energy use, but I went out and bought some of the LED lights, and there's a couple different varieties that you can get. Target was selling them this Christmas and last Christmas, and I think I saw them at Menards as well. I tried looking for LED bulbs because we were going to design a new lighting fixture, a large one, to cover a big work area in our kitchen. And I couldn't, from what I could tell from the internet, and I haven't seen any bulbs at the big box stores around, is that the LED light arrays don't actually provide enough light at the moment for general lighting purposes. But I have found little flashlights. Stanley makes a flashlight with a movable head and a tripod legs, and it's supposed to last for quite a long time on a few batteries. So we've gotten that. And I also wanted to say that Philips makes a linear fluorescent bulb that has a green end, and the green end is a sign that it's got lower amounts of mercury in it. I think a lot of people don't realize that there's mercury in fluorescence and aren't being very careful about about getting rid of their dead ones. The long ones do die eventually. And so I really think we need to do a better job of telling people how to dispose of them so that the mercury won't be spread into the atmosphere, the mercury vapor.
Absolutely. You've made some great points. First, on the mercury, all fluorescent lights, as well as virtually all HID lights, high-intensity discharge lights, mercury vapor, metal halide, and high-pressure sodium, they all contain mercury because you need a mercury vapor gas that the electric arc passes through that is ignited and creates, in all these cases, ultraviolet light, which is then absorbed by a phosphor coating on the inside of the glass. And that phosphor coating then starts glowing and emits the visible light or the white light that we're used to seeing. But because of that mercury, it is very important to properly dispose of old fluorescent and HID lamps. And I would suggest contacting the local municipal waste authority to ask what the options are for safe disposal of these lamps. They can be recycled. They tend to both the lamps as well as ballasts can be recycled, and the companies that pick these up will actually recycle the glass and recover the mercury for reuse in other applications. So very important priority to dispose of these properly. In terms of LED lighting, I haven't myself had a chance to use Christmas lights, although we looked into these a little bit this Christmas, and I will probably buy some next year. When you're using colored lights, the efficacy, which is a lighting term used to refer to the efficiency at which the light is delivered, is actually higher than it is with white LEDs. So with colored Christmas lights, the reds and greens, you get quite a bit of light output for the electricity that's used. A lot of the development work that's been going into LEDs has to do with white LEDs, and that's where the real improvement is happening, but where there's still a long way to go to deliver the area light that the listener spoke of in a kitchen or a bathroom application or living room or really any application around the home. The other thing about LEDs is that it's possible to focus them fairly precisely so that in certain applications where you know precisely where you want that light, the efficacy can be quite good or the effect of a delivery of light. And that's the case with a flashlight where you can shine it, often a very bright beam on a very precise area, but also with traffic lights where those lights are, the LEDs are focused on the cars that are going to be waiting at the light.
I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. And also, I think we probably need to clarify here in terms of recycling. This is something you can't put out, these fluorescent bulbs and ballasts. You don't want to put that out on with your curbside recyclables. This is a special kind of recycling project.
Yes, great point. And, you know, often they won't even pick them up. You will have to drop them off at a recycling location. You might also check with retailers. I know some Home Depot stores will collect and properly dispose of fluorescent lights. I'm not sure if Walmart will do that, but there are, you know, a number of options in the area. But I think a municipal waste agency will be familiar with what the options are.
Yeah. In the past, we occasionally will, every couple of years, the county or the cities will come together and have one of these events, and you can drop things off, including fluorescent bulbs and old, you know, computer monitors, television sets, and that kind of thing, as well as hazardous wastes in the term in form of paints and other kinds of chemical solvents and the like. But it's, you know, it's one of these things where you almost have to be patient at the moment anyway, and store these things until you can properly dispose of them.
Right. I've got a big box in my garage where I've been putting fluorescent lamps for years that have stopped working. You know, they have a long lifetime, but they do eventually fail. And I just haven't gotten around to taking them down for proper disposal. But I do keep them separate. I don't put them in with conventional trash.
Hmm. To what extent is the concern over the costs of heating, cooling, and powering our homes driving the interest in green homes and green buildings?
Well, I think that's been a big driver in the last couple of years. You know, we've seen prices go up pretty significantly. You know, they rose very dramatically with gasoline, you know, not quite as quickly with natural gas and heating fuel, but you know, energy prices are going up, and many parts of the country are going to be seeing very significant increases in electricity prices over the coming couple of years. You know, that's a regulated industry, so it takes longer for increases in rates to go into effect, but that will be happening because costs of producing electricity are going up. And so this is a big driver, and that's, you know, I think energy costs have been probably the number one driver in the last few years that have pushed people toward considering green homes. And you know, I think we'll see more of that. You know, the prices of energy will continue to go up and down. They're quite volatile, but, you know, even when they're going down, it illustrates a risk of, you know, being exposed to that variability and not knowing what your energy bills are going to be from month to month.
Well, it will be interesting to see what happens here in Illinois, as we've had a rate freeze in place for a number of years, and it has just ended, and so the cost of electricity is going to rise significantly beginning this month, January 2007.
Yeah, there are a lot of places that are projecting, you know, as much as 50% electricity price increases in the next year.
Oh.
I don't know if it'll be quite that bad where you are, but
40 to 50% is what they're saying.
Well, mm-hmm.
Yeah, significant. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Alex Wilson is our guest this afternoon. He's the author of Your Green Home: A Guide to Planning a Healthy, Environmentally Friendly New Home. Listeners, you can join the conversation, the discussion this afternoon with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. You mentioned earlier the size of a home being an important factor in how green it is. Do you see on the horizon a reverse in the trend of the larger and larger and larger home?
I think so. You know, when we look at the history of house size in this country, it's been a pretty dramatic upward trend since about 1950. You know, in 1950, the average house in the U.S. was about 1,000 square feet. It's now over 2,500 square feet. And, you know, even as that house size has increased, our family size has decreased by about a third. So the, you know, area per square foot per family member has tripled in not too many decades. You know, I hope that the size will go down because to a very significant extent, the resource use in building a new home and the energy use in operating that home are pretty directly proportional to the size of that home. So, you know, if we can downsize by a third, you know, that's comparable to a pretty significant increase in insulation levels. So it's certainly a high priority. You know, the problem, one of the problems is that we, as consumers, just have more and more stuff that we need to have a place for. So I think, you know, a realistic reduction in house size is going to mean for a lot of people, you know, changing the amount of stuff they keep.
Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of listeners now waiting to talk with us. We're going to go next to a listener in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I have two questions. One is about the move that Boston made to have more sustainably built homes. And I was just wondering if you could speak to the political process they went through to get that accomplished. Obviously, in our kind of community, we don't, you know, we have a number of municipalities in the region that would have to coordinate to make that something like that happen. But if you know anything about how that was achieved, I'd like to hear about that. And the other question I had was, if you could just list you've talked about a number of things people can do in their existing homes, and if there are any other of your favorite ones for people who live in older homes that may want to try to improve them, what else they can do in addition to, you know, lighting and installing shower heads and things like that.
Sure. First of all, relative to Boston and the political process, first of all, that program relates just to commercial buildings, you know, larger commercial buildings. But my understanding is that it was really a grassroots effort that led to the passage of that landmark legislation. And, you know, I think in most cities around the country where we've seen programs like that adopted, it's really been a, you know, a group of often a fairly small number of people that said, you know, let's do better. You know, let's, you know, at least require for our own buildings that they exhibit high levels of energy performance and green attributes. So I think a fairly small number of people can make a significant difference in a community and push through some pretty dramatic changes.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah, now as for strategies for existing homes, I guess my starting point in most cases would be to bring in a weatherization specialist who can come into your home and kind of examine the insulation, the air tightness of the home, and get a sense of and communicate to you how much energy it's using and what the opportunities are for improving its energy performance. They often use something called a blower door that pressurizes or depressurizes the house. And by measuring the difference in pressure between the inside and outside and how hard the fan is working, they can measure very precisely how airtight the house is. And then they can also look at insulation in the walls. In some cases, they'll use a special camera on a cold day, for example, looking at the house and seeing areas in red that indicate a lot of heat flowing through the wall. And, you know, very often those weatherization contractors can come in and improve your energy performance fairly dramatically and often without too much effort by tightening up the really significant air leakage areas, in some cases adding insulation to an attic, in some cases blowing insulation into walls. And that's a really good starting point to do an energy audit and then carry out a program to improve the energy performance of the home. Other strategies would be adding storm windows to a home if there are just single glazed windows, just single thickness windows. You know, it's a lot cheaper than replacing windows with modern, very high performance windows, but can work very effectively. We talked about water conservation. You know, I would look, you know, not only at showers, but the next time you're replacing a clothes washing machine, look for a horizontal axis or a front-loading washing machine that does a good job washing clothes with far less water, typically a third to a half the water as a conventional top-loading washer. Some of the dishwashers on the market today use, you know, half the water of older dishwashers. Refrigerators, today's refrigerators use far less electricity than a refrigerator 10 or 20 years old. So there are significant potential whenever we're replacing an existing appliance. It's often hard to justify getting rid of a perfectly good appliance to, you know, just to save energy, but that can also make sense in many cases.
Great.
Okay. Very good. Thanks for the questions this afternoon. Next, we're going to go, we're going to head north to Rockford, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Look, I just tuned you on, and I've got two questions. First of all, I bought some of those energy-saving light bulbs to put inside my lights, and I got a question. Now, are they, you know, they're mini fluorescent bulbs, but I was raised the old way that when you're in a work area, you leave the lights, the fluorescent lights on, because it's cheaper to keep them burning than to turn them on and off all the time. And am I wasting money here just by turning them on and off when I'm using them?
Yeah, there's often a misconception that it saves energy to leave the fluorescent lights on rather than turning them off and then on again. Yeah, that's research into that question has pretty well disproven that belief. You know, it almost always makes sense to turn the lamp off.
So no matter what, just
turn it off. If you're going to be out of the room for more than 10 minutes or a half hour, I would turn the lights off. You know, it will shorten their life a little bit by switching them on and off. But
who cares if we're saving on the monthly power bill?
Yeah, and if you're not using them as many hours a day, they are probably going to last longer in terms of months or years than you know, if you left them on all the time.
Okay, perfect. Well, that was a misconception. You know, it wasn't a preconceived misconception, but that's the way we were raised in the 60s.
So. Yeah, it's a very common misconception.
Okay, well, look, I appreciate that. And one short question. I'm in a converted hotel, and they tore out all the radiators and put in electric baseboard heat to make sure that each of the units pay their own heat. Is there any tricks to save on that other than our normal putting up plastic on the windows and caulking all the, you know, sealing the place?
Yeah, I would start with a good energy audit by somebody who really knows what he or she is doing. And, you know, look at buttoning up the building, you know, both tightening it up, reducing air leakage, and ideally insulating it some more. And then beyond that, you know, you might at some point want to look at fuel switching to shift from electricity to natural gas or...
Oh, see, I'm renting it in an apartment, so I got no choice.
Mm. Oh, okay.
So it's a nice, well, it's a classy old place, but, you know, I'm seeing my electric bills go higher and higher. But, okay, but do my standard, make sure that I've cut out all the old leaks in my own place.
Yes.
Look, I appreciate your help. And
sure thing.
Thanks so much.
Next, we talk with a listener in Charleston, Illinois, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Appreciate the show. This has been real informative. I was interested in the Boston situation, and then I liked his comment at first about going siding your home is a real good thought to start the process. One thing that might relate to that first caller's question, I came across a few years ago, back in the 70s, our first a little bit of energy problems. excellent publication in Kansas by the Kansas Cooperative Extension that talked about landscaping to improve energy efficiency around your home. Things like putting border plantings of evergreens around the base of the home, and then also shade trees that would shade the east and west sides of the house, and that would lose their leaves in the wintertime, and then allow sun to come in and that sort of thing, and help with passive solar heating in the wintertime and such. And so I just thought that might be another thing of interest to some people that might be looking at trying to do something for their older homes.
Absolutely. It's a great point, and one that we tend to not pay enough attention to today. There are often significant ways to reduce energy consumption by the way we manage our landscapes. And the most significant way we can reduce energy use is by shading homes from the unwanted summer sun. You know, and particularly this is the case on the east and west side of a home. So consider, you know, planting shade trees, planting vines on trellises, things like that. Tall annuals such as hollyhocks that can, you know, help block even the fairly low sun in the late afternoon on the west side of a home. And that can yield dramatic energy savings by cutting down on air conditioning use. So it's a great point. The other strategy with landscaping is blocking cold winter winds, and this might involve, you know, hedges, as the listener mentioned, of conifers, you know, that maintain their needles year-round on the north or northwest of the home, depending on where the prevailing winds are coming from in the winter.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the program.
Thank you. Next, we talk with a listener in Bourbonnais in Kankakee County. Line 2, hi.
Hi. I have two matters. Hello?
Yep.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. The first is to urge you and everybody listening not to consider the electric rate increase as a done deal. There's still a chance that our legislature will block that. And in fact, just this morning I got a call from the Citizens Utility Board, who have a campaign going for that, and they left me an 800 number to call to work with our legislators on this. Can I give you the number?
Sure.
It's 800-719-3020. So,
okay.
You know, we could pull this out yet. The power of the people.
Okay, thanks for the call this
hello?
Afternoon. Yes, go ahead. Anything else?
Yes, thank you. Can I ask our guests about retrofitting your home for solar?
Sure. Good question.
Thank you.
Yes, there are a number of things that can be done for solar energy. You know, it's in an existing building, the existing house is going to be a big determinant as to how far you can go. But one of the easiest things on existing buildings is to add solar water heating. It's not going to be real cheap. You might expect to spend $2,500 to $5,000 for a complete solar water heating system. And it will necessitate having a south-facing roof that panels can be installed on.
I have that.
So that's one possibility. Another is to better utilize passive solar heating. And passive solar is really allowing the house to serve as the solar collector and heat storage system. So it's basically south-facing windows and then providing materials in the home that can store that heat during the daytime and then re-radiate that heat at night. So, for example, a tile floor or a concrete slab floor can absorb that sunlight during the daytime and keep the house warmer at night. And then the third strategy, which tends to be the highest cost, but in the long term may hold the greatest potential, particularly for those concerned about electricity prices, is photovoltaics or solar electricity. And these are panels that are put on the roof that generate electricity. In general, today, photovoltaic installations are only going to be cost-effective in homes that do not have easy access to the electric grid. So if you're building a new home and it's going to be a half mile or more from power lines, it may be, you know, very attractive economically to put that money into, put the money you would spend to bring power to the site instead into a photovoltaic system and batteries to store that electricity. But as the cost of photovoltaics comes down, it's going to be increasingly attractive to put them in, even in homes that are hooked up to the electric grid, and to run meters through a net metering arrangement with utility company so that the utility buys back the electricity generated by your photovoltaics when it exceeds the usage in the home, and, you know, essentially runs the meter backwards. So those three strategies for retrofitting homes for solar are, you know, what I would suggest looking into.
And how common are government incentive programs for solar?
Yeah, there are some federal programs. There are federal tax credits that are in effect right now that will pay 30% as a tax credit for solar installations up to $2,000. And a tax credit puts much more money back in your pocket than a tax deduction, so that's an important distinction to make. Some states add to that with additional state credits. I don't believe Illinois does, but I could be wrong about that. So there are some opportunities, you know, both for solar electricity and solar water heating. I don't think they're the similar, you know, as significant benefits will be available for passive solar, but there are some opportunities out there.
Very good. I hope that helps our listener in Bourbonnais. Alex Wilson, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're very welcome, Celeste.
Alex Wilson is the president of Building Green Incorporated. He's the editor of Environmental Building News, and he is the author of Your Green Home, A Guide to Planning a Healthy, Environmentally Friendly New Home. The book is published by New Society Publishers.